Thanks very much, Stuart, and thanks again for allowing me to speak to this forum for, I think, the fourth year in a row. So what I want to talk about today is, first of all, talk about how I can get the slide clicker to work, but is the funding of the, it's about, the as Stuart said, the present and possible future of secured issuance. So the funding of the banking system has been very much front and centre at various times throughout the financial crisis, and it's under heavy scrutiny today. The particular aspect of bank funding that I want to focus on today is the role of secured funding, which is quite obvious given the topic of this conference. But the development I wish to highlight is the quite divergent trends in the composition of bank funding over the past 4 years, particularly in the terms of the share of secured and unsecured funding. The most striking example is in Europe, where banks have raised around half of their wholesale funding in 2011 in the form of secured funding, whereas in the US there has almost been a complete absence of secured funding outside that done by the agencies. Instead, the banking system funding in the US has almost entirely been driven by deposits. In Australia, the composition of bank funding has also changed a lot over the past 4 years, but in a manner more along the lines of the US than that of Europe. So these developments reflect changes on both the supply and the demand side of the market, including that banking systems generally have experienced slow or even negative growth on the asset side of the balance sheet, but deposit growth has been faster. Hence, customer deposits, both retail and corporate, have accounted for a considerably larger share of bank funding than they did pre-crisis. So as a result, the need for banks to raise funds in wholesale markets has declined. On the other side of the market, investors, particularly over the past year and particularly right now in Europe, have exhibited a strong preference to purchase secured forms of funding from banks. And as I will discuss later, it is not clear to me that the delineation between secured and unsecured funding for the banking system is quite so stark as current market conditions would imply. So at this point, it's worth thinking about the various forms of funding available to banks. And so for the purposes of this talk, I will slightly simplify things into five categories of bank funding. So first of all, there's equity funding. Secondly, deposits, some portion of which may be insured or guaranteed through various with schemes which vary across countries. There's unsecured wholesale funding in the form of bond issuance or short-term paper. Asset-backed issuance, such as RMBS, where the bank sells a security backed by a pool of assets to the market. The important point here is the assets are no longer present on the bank's books after the sale. And then covered bonds, where the issuance is again backed by a pool of assets, but in this case, the assets remain on the balance sheet of the issuing bank, and the investor is given an additional claim on the balance sheet of the bank. So note that the first three forms of funding are claims on the bank's balance sheet as a whole. That's equity, deposits, and unsecured funding. In the case of deposits in many countries, insurance, or guarantees provide protection up to some level, but any deposit larger than that covered by those schemes is a form of unsecured funding. Asset-backed issuance is obviously secured issuance, while covered bonds are primarily secured issuance, but with an element of unsecured funding in terms of the recourse to the balance sheet as a whole. So what I want to do today is focus on the last three modes of funding, which are generally characterised as wholesale funding. That's unsecured, RMBS, and then covered bonds. So first I'll summarise developments in bank funding in Australia, the US, Europe and the UK since the financial crisis began over 4 years ago. And I'll talk a bit about central bank actions in each of those areas as they've had implications for bank funding. And then finally, I'll pose some questions about how wholesale funding might evolve in the future, focusing particularly on the sustainability and desirability of the current investor preference for secured issuance. So the graphs I'll show you shortly illustrate the patterns of bank wholesale funding over the past 5 years in the US, UK, Europe and Australia. The one source of funding which is on those graphs, which I'm not going to talk much about, is government guaranteed bond issuance, which ran from sort of September 2008 until the cessation of the guarantee on new issues at various times in various countries. So in every case, bar Australia for those four countries, it is noteworthy that the level of wholesale issuance in 2011 is substantially below that in 2007. So 4 years down the track, and wholesale issuance is less than it was 4 years ago. So one reason for that is this. In fact, one of the main reasons for that is this. So this shows you credit growth in each of those four markets in annual terms. And you can see that basically, you know, from 2008, the size of US bank balance sheets has actually been in decline. In the UK, they've basically been flat since early 2009. In Europe, they've barely grown. But in Australia, we've had, well, relative to that graph at least, a reasonable pace of credit growth or balance sheet growth, although much less than obviously was the case in the 15 years prior to 2007. So that's one side of the balance sheet. On the other important factor is the relatively strong growth in deposits in all four regions. So this trend is well documented for the US, Europe and the UK in a paper by a colleague of mine on the Committee on the Global Financial System, which is a BIS committee, where they show how much deposit growth has driven bank funding in right across the world, actually, over the past 3 or 4 years. In Australia, since mid-2007, deposits have grown at an annualised pace of 11% compared with credit growth of 5%. So as a result, while the level of wholesale issuance by Australian banks is about the same in 2011 as it was in 2007, that amounts to a significantly smaller share of overall bank funding. So let me now just run through quickly the developments in wholesale funding in each of those four areas, and starting with the US. So what I got here is we split the graph, splits this up into orange, the unsecured funding. The light blue is guaranteed funding, which was, as you can see, was primarily 2008-2009. Blue is covered bond funding, of which there was there's a small slither in the US in 2007. They're currently debating whether they bring back or try and enhance covered bond issuance in the US. And then the grey, which is the dominant one, is agency mortgage-backed securities. You can see in 2010 and 2011, in fact, most of the time, almost all of the mortgage-backed securities issuance has been by the agencies. So as you recall, the agencies purchase eligible loans from mortgage originators, including the banks, and either keep them on their own balance sheets or pull them into MBS to be sold to investors. So that's one thing which is clear from that graph, is just how dominant a role the agencies are playing in wholesale funding markets in the US at the moment. The other thing which is clear from that is the significant decline in unsecured bond issuance, from 20% of wholesale funding in the US in 2007 to 11% this year. The change in issuance patterns in the US is also affected by the fact that a sizable share of housing lending in the US was funded off balance sheet. So as that source of housing finance has dried up significantly, and housing lending growth has been negative for more than 2 years now, a much greater share of lending has been in the conforming market supported by the agencies. So the changes in funding are much larger for the shadow banking system in the US than they are for the balance sheet funding of the overall banking system. More generally, when comparing the changes in funding across the four regions, it is important to bear in mind in the US that a significantly smaller share of finance to both the household and the business sector was and is provided by the banking system. So this is showing developments primarily around the banking system in the US. The story for the non-banking system, which is a much sizable share of the market, is even worse, if that's where you want to characterise it. So that's the story in the US. So primarily a story of the agencies dominating wholesale funding. If I turn to Europe, unsecured issuance accounted for a little over half of total issuance in 2011, and it's a similar share in 2007. But the issuance pattern varies quite markedly across institutions. The stronger institutions in Europe have generally had ready access to unsecured funding, but a number of institutions have been shut out of unsecured markets, particularly since the middle of this year. The composition of secured funding, which is the blue and the red bars there, has also changed dramatically, with covered issuance accounting for the vast bulk of secured issuance in 2011, compared with a roughly 50-50 split between MBS and covered in 2007. The covered market has been the primary source of funding for those institutions unable to tap the unsecured markets. But the secured issuance data in Europe are also significantly affected by self-secured issues, both MBS and covered, which are retained on the balance sheet of European financial institutions to access liquidity at the ECB. So while those blue bars and those red bars don't look too unhealthy in terms of issuance size, a large chunk of that has just been issued, kept on the balance sheet, and then repoed at the ECB for liquidity, particularly by those banks who are not only shut out of the unsecured market, are also shut out of the secured market, and the only market they've got left is the ECB. So the other issue is that the aggregate figures for Europe mask some quite significant differences across countries and institutions, with, for example, secured issuance by German institutions almost entirely being in the form of covered bonds, while banks in the Netherlands, for example, almost entirely issue RMBS. So a big difference across countries, across banks, and then also how much of that is actually going to the market rather than going to the ECB. In the UK, the share of unsecured issuance of total issuance is about the same in 2011 as it was in 2007, but you can see the number in 2011 is a hell of a lot less than it was in 2007. The share of funding from MBS has declined, but has been fully compensated for by an increase in the share of covered bond issuance. Now, part of the shift in the UK reflects a compositional shift in the industry. So entities such as Northern Rock, which sourced a large share of their funding from MBS, were a large part of the market in 2007. Obviously, they're not quite so big as that today. And then, similarly to the European situation in the UK, a fair chunk of the MBS, particularly in 2008, so that big red bar in 2008, almost predominantly reflects self-securitised issuance, where banks put together mortgages and then took them to the Bank of England under the special liquidity scheme, about which I'll talk about a little more in a minute. So Europe and the UK, the security issuance data are inflated, if you want to put it that way, by the issues that banks have put together to access funding from their central banks. So let me turn to Australia. Now, the Australian data, which we've got here, does not include self-securitised issuance. This is all on-market issuance. So from here, you can see that the share of unsecured funding has actually increased between 2007 and 2011, in contrast to that in the other three countries, or three regions. So to some extent, this reflects a compositional effect. A number of institutions, some banks, but particularly non-banks, are significantly more reliant on MBS for their funding than the larger banks. So as market share has shifted towards the larger banks, so that now account for a much larger share of the overall financial sector, so the composition of funding has also shifted to be more like those of the major banks than the rest of the financial system. Obviously, in Australia, the covered bond market is in its infancy, so there is a little blue bar there in 2011, which reflects the first two issues last week following the passage of the enabling legislation in October. So nearly all the secured issuance in Australia this year has been in the form of MBS. Though, as shown earlier, credit growth in Australia, while slow relative to recent history, has outstripped that in the other three regions. But it is apparent from the Australian data that total wholesale issuance is broadly the same in 2011 as it was in 2007. So given balance sheets are larger now than they were in 2007, by a reasonable amount, a significant share of the funding of the banking system, or much larger share, has come from deposits rather than from the wholesale market. So let me now talk a bit about central bank support and how that has affected some of these developments. So what I got here is the size of the balance sheets of the Bank of England, the Fed, the ECB and us. It's in index form, so the actual size actually varies quite significantly, but just gives you an indication of the changes in the size of these balance sheets. So the Bank of England's balance sheet is three times larger than it was in 2007, so the Fed about the same. The ECB's about double the size of 2007. We're actually a bit lower than we were in 2007. In our case, at least, that reflects the fact of the Future Fund taking the deposits it had with us and then investing them in a broader range of assets. So let me talk a little bit about each of those balance sheet developments. So in the US, their large increase reflects the Fed's program of quantitative easing, which has injected a large amount of liquidity into the banking system. The Fed's obviously also had a program of asset purchases, which has included over $1 trillion of purchases of mortgage-backed securities. Similarly, in the UK, the Bank of England has conducted a large asset purchase program. It has also provided support to the banking system, as I mentioned, through the special liquidity scheme, where banks exchange MBS or covered bonds for treasury bills to more easily obtain liquidity in the market. At its peak, about just under £300 billion of securities were exchanged for £185 billion of treasury bills. Drawdowns under that scheme closed in 2007, and nearly all of it's actually been repaid this year. In fact, that scheme will be completely repaid by early next year. In Europe, the ECB has assisted bank funding through its fixed rate full allotment, or all-you-can-eat liquidity provision operations. So that's enabled banks that are having difficulty obtaining funding in the market to borrow from the ECB against acceptable collateral at the ECB's policy rate for terms of up to 1 year or so. Some of that collateral, in fact, has taken the form of secured issuance retained on the books of the issuing banks. So the ECB's directly got under repo a fair chunk of the secured issuance over the last few years. It's also supported bank issuance through its covered bond purchase program, where it's actually gone out and bought covered bonds in the market. So it's an initial phase was in July 2009. The ECB purchased around 60 billion of covered bonds. It's recently restarted that program with the intention of purchasing another 40 billion euro of covered bonds. So the ECB's balance sheet is a combination of a little bit of asset purchases. It's also obviously got its sovereign debt purchases around 150 billion euro. Most of the increase in the ECB's bank balance sheet is providing liquidity assistance to the banking system. In Australia, the RBA provided liquidity support to the banking system through our repo operations, including against self-securitised mortgages at the height of dislocation in funding markets in 08 and 09. But you can see from that graph that by sometime around in 2009, our balance sheet basically returned to its normal level. So that's where we are at the moment. Let me now talk a bit about where I think things might go in the future. So I'll explain why I've got this slide up in the middle in a minute. When I showed this talk to members of my staff, they had absolutely no idea who the Saints are. So I'm hoping this audience is a little more educated, or old, as the case may be, and understand what I'm talking about. Anyhow, I'll get to that in a minute. So there's a clear preference on the part of investors in the current risk-averse climate for secured investments. A number of financial institutions, as I said, particularly in Europe, have been only able to access funding through covered bonds. I have to say, I don't see this trend towards predominantly secured issuance as being sustainable. It's a difficult message for this forum to digest, I know, but securitisation is not the be-all and end-all of funding. Banks can't encumber their balance sheets through secured issuance to such an extent that unsecured issuance and even deposit gathering is no longer possible. Too much issuance of covered bonds and you're effectively back in an unsecured world anyway. Hence, most jurisdictions put a cap on the amount of covered bonds that can be issued. In Australia, the total amount of encumbrance is 8%, which given the degree of over-collateralisation required in covered bonds, translates into an issuance level well below that, and well below a level which is likely to compromise the safety of deposits. Nevertheless, the introduction of covered bonds does subordinate unsecured debt holders to a degree. Any pricing gain obtained from issuing covered bonds is likely to be offset to some extent by a demand from unsecured debt holders for more compensation in the future. So I see the role of covered bonds as primarily broadening the investor base rather than a means of reducing overall funding costs for banks. There is clearly a segmented investor base out there. Some investors will only buy covered and have no interest in RMBS or unsecured. Other investors are completely happy with RMBS and have no interest in covered bonds, which pay a lower yield for a very similar credit exposure. I would expect that covered bonds are likely to be primarily an offshore funding source for the Australian banks, with the domestic investor base much more comfortable with RMBS. So in that regard, I think it's worth posing the question as to how different the various forms of bank funding actually are. All of the forms of funding are claims on a bank's balance sheet in one form or another. Unsecured bank funding, including deposits, is a claim on the balance sheet of the bank as a whole. The assets underpinning that claim are the same form as those which back the secured issuance. An RMBS is not an on-balance sheet claim, but it is a claim on a set of assets very much representative of a sizable part of the balance sheet. In Australia, at least, the mortgages which are securitised by banks in their RMBS issues have similar characteristics to those mortgages which remain on the bank's balance sheets. The same is also true of the covered bond issues by the Australian banks, at least the two which have them so far. So the underlying assets aren't that much different. Rather, the difference, and this is the key difference, is the degree of credit enhancement provided by subordination in the case of RMBS, or over-collateralisation and additional recourse to the balance sheet in the case of covered bonds. But the strong motivation for the current preference of investors for secured issuance is about repositioning themselves towards the front of the creditor queue. That is the fundamental point of differentiation between the various forms of funding, where you stand in the creditor queue. Ultimately, everyone can't be at the front of the creditor queue. In theory, or in at least a less risk-averse environment than the current one, pricing should equalise the incentives to issue and purchase the various forms of funding, depending on where you sit in the creditor queue. Investors should be compensated for their risks of being further down the creditor queue with a higher risk premium. In today's world, that risk premium in some markets seems to be about infinity. That, I just don't see that as being sustainable. In today's environment, there are obviously plenty of examples where market pricing is not always sending the most accurate signal, but I just don't see it can be the case that unsecured issuance can be regarded as completely untenable at any price, and secured issuance being the only form of viable issuance. In due course, I think investors in bank paper might again come to the realisation that there is not as stark a difference between secured and unsecured issuance as current pricing would suggest. And as I said, in Europe, that pricing differential seems to be somewhere close to infinite. So this is where I get to the slide now. Investors need to heed the seminal words of these guys, the Saints, in know your product. You need to do the due diligence on your product, understand the differences and the similarities between the products, and price appropriately. I just don't see that's happening at the moment. It's very easy to do not due to due diligence and just run to something which you think puts you at the front of the creditor queue. So in the end, I think we should return to a world where banks access all five of the sources of funding I outlined at the beginning of my talk, that is, secured and unsecured issuance. It is useful to have a diverse range of funding instruments at hand, as at various points in time, including right now, some markets are more functional than others. But a world where the only source of funding available is secured funding, I just don't see as being sustainable. There needs to be much more those risks need to be appropriately priced, for sure, but I just don't see that pricing differential as being one which makes unsecured issuance unviable and secured issuance the only form of funding. So with that, let me leave it there, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the conference. Thanks.
Well, Guy, I think Charles has made a point the same as you around knowing what you're buying, so the need to do diligence and the complexity. Just to get a reaction from you around the structural impediment, you were making a very strong point about different funding sources and secured, unsecured. Just your reaction to that question?
I think it's actually an issue. I would actually put a slightly more positive spin on what Charles said. It is about investor education, and it's a question of making... I would have think any half-decent fixed income manager in Australia would actually be more than competent enough to be able to assess that, and should be able to talk to their superannuation trustees, who probably do have some distrust of the product. And there's an important role for education. It's also an important role of selling the product for what it is and what it is not. It is not a liquid instrument. There's not going to be anything, I don't think, anytime soon, which is going to provide liquidity, guaranteed liquidity around that product. So one shouldn't position it in the portfolio expecting that liquidity to be there. That's not what it's there for. What you should be selling, I would have thought, is the fact that this thing has delivered a very high rate of return, particularly at the spreads it's being sold at the moment. If you think about it, if you look at those covered issues last week, 150, 160 points over for a AAA security, that's an incredibly cheap price, I think. Against an asset, not the product's obviously brand new, but an asset whose properties in Australia are pretty well known and are pretty, I would have thought, reasonably easy to sell, and got a long track record to look at. So I would have thought the investor education, or actually probably more particularly the superannuation trustee education, should be an important part of a fixed income manager's job, and I don't think it actually should be all that difficult. The Australian products are actually fairly straightforward. They don't come with a lot of bells and whistles. And so it's a question of differentiating that product from the products which gave the industry the brand damage in other markets. So I think there's an incredibly important role for investor education. But as I said, that said, you've got to make sure that you're not selling the product for what it isn't. And I said, it's not a source of liquidity. I don't actually think that even necessarily delivering a bullet structure is something which is going to be all that beneficial. It's a question of selling the product for what it is and not trying to turn it into something that it isn't.
Okay. Just picking up on the point and really giving this to you, Guy, and it's a question from the audience, what role should regulators play in working with government to actually support mortgage competition? So from the RBA's perspective, and then I'll flick that to Greg Medcraft to answer as well.
I'm never entirely clear what people actually mean by mortgage competition. So that question keeps on getting asked. And I don't what people actually mean. If people mean lower interest rates, which I think is mostly what some people have in mind, then, the mortgage rates are about where we want them to be. Otherwise, we'd do something about that. So I'm not quite sure if that's what people mean. That could be higher or lower, so it's not saying anything. But I think that's what actually people mostly have in mind. I mean, at the moment out there, there is a reasonable amount of competition in the mortgage space. And yes, there are less players in that market than there were in 2007. But I suppose from our point of view, probably similar motivation as Charles, is we might want to make sure that, you know, the appropriate lending standards are being pursued, and then we're not building up imbalances which are going to cause us problems down the track. Generally, more competition is a good thing, but it's a question. There is a balance in this space, in particular, between competition and financial stability, and those two things don't always push in exactly the same direction. It's something we're cognizant on. I suppose there's actually more a role for, without handballing it too hard, but it's more a role for Charles and APRA. Not competition per se, but lending standards than it is for ourselves. I said it's something we're mindful of in terms of the effect it actually has on the macro conditions, but what we ultimately care about is the price and the supply of the product.
This is a question from Guy, and the one thing about doing this live SMS questioning is you're never quite sure if you're allowed to ask the question, but I'll give it a go. Guy, one of the somebody in the audience wants to know, your colleague Philip Lowe said recently that we wasn't expecting a disaster in Europe, just from the look of the externalities on the market and funding costs and trends. Is that still the case?
The case is that we're
still not expecting a disaster from Europe.
Someone can ask that question of Glenn on Thursday, I think, rather than ask that of me today, because I think he's better place to answer that one rather than today. And we'll probably be in a different place by Thursday than where it is today anyhow.
Yeah, well played. I'm just conscious of the time, and we've gone way over. I just want to ask one last question of each of you, just for your views, which is the market is doing a lot of effort around reshaping. So a lot of the initiatives of the industry and the ASF, both proactively and reactively. Just to get the views from each of you about, do you think the market is actually reshaping of its own accord, or is it doing it because the regulators are intervening and forcing that, and just drawing out the differences here to overseas?
Yeah, no, I agree with both Charles and Greg. I mean, it's primarily the investors which are driving this. I mean, they're the ones who are actually buying the product, broadly speaking. I mean, as Greg said, the OFM's buying some as well, which is having some shape on the nature of the product being sold to the market. But ultimately, isn't a question for the investors. To some extent, I suppose, pre-2007, the issuers probably had the upper hand. Now the investors well and truly have the upper hand, and you've seen that pendulum swing a long way. So it is, I think, ultimately the investors buying it. I mean, the role for the regulation is to provide the confidence around the structure so that when you're told you're getting a product which has certain characteristics, and indeed is a product with those characteristics. But ultimately, and it comes back to what I was saying in my speech, it's the investor who's buying the product. It's the investor who needs to do the due diligence on the product. The regulators can provide some structures so at least there's some confidence around that product. But in the end, it's surely an investor-driven process.
Okay.